This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and whoever you are listening, thank you. And this is the October 2023 Literature Review Series. Very lucky to be joined by two special guests, Haley Burns and Caitlin Simonson. And the October 2023 Literature Review Series episode starts off with our featured studies, where today we highlight seven of the most notable publications from October 2023. Then the discussion shifts to pulmonary, a little EM, tox, trauma, potpourri section, a renal endocrine focus, followed by the category featuring articles voted on by you, friends of the pod, in the pharmacist featured section, aka the front of the fridge. So if you want to vote in future episodes, be sure to follow on Twitter or X, Instagram, at Pharmacy to Dose. And then the episode closes with our non-clinical section, Sweet Emotions. Now, quick reminder, 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness bracket is happening right now as this episode's being released. If you want to vote on the most influential, important, and best trial in critical care, you, the listener, get to vote and make that ultimate selection. So again, at Pharmacy to Dose, and go vote. So we have some great articles highlighted with two even better guests. So here we go.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Very, very lucky to be joined by our not one, but two special guests, of course, for the October 2023 Literature Review Series, Haley Burns and Caitlin Simonson. Now, Haley is the PGY2 critical care pharmacy resident at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. She put the "the" for the record for those wondering, and that's at Haley _RX36. And Caitlin is the PGY2 critical care pharmacy resident at Ochsner Health in New Orleans. Welcome, Caitlin and Haley. How are you both doing today?
Doing well. I'm excited to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so I'm excited to be a guest.
Also doing great, Nick. Thanks so much for having us.
The excitement's all on this end. This is awesome. You all picked some amazing articles. We have some great things to dive into. And our discussion, of course, starts today, as we do in all Literature Review Series episodes, with our featured article discussion. However, we have not one, not two, Not 3, 4, 5, or 6. That is correct. We are working with 7 featured articles in this section today. So kicking off our featured article discussion is a 2023 JAMA study entitled UK REBOA, Researching Emergency Department Resuscitative Endovascular Balloon Occlusion of the Aorta in Trauma Patients with Exsanguinating Hemorrhage. So what does this mean exactly? Well, in extremely critically ill trauma patients, a technique to try and temporarily stop the bleeding is called REBOA, where a balloon is percutaneously inflated in the aorta, and the thought is that this occlusion can help temporarily stop the ongoing hemorrhage until you can get that definitive bleeding control. Now, REBOA is actually an acronym, and it stands for, like the title said, Resuscitative Endovascular Balloon Occlusion of the Aorta. Now, this was a UK multi-center, open-label, Bayesian group sequential registry-enabled randomized clinical trial. And they looked to determine if basically REBOA in addition to standard care was more effective than standard care alone. So it took place in 16 major trauma centers in the UK. The authors specifically mentioned that the clinicians had a complete specific training to use REBOA. If you look in the supplementary materials, there's like sample two-day agendas. So they certainly spent time learning about this procedure. Now, they enrolled patients 16 years or older with confirmed or suspected life-threatening torso hemorrhage that was thought to be amenable to REBOA adjunctive treatment, right? The big key exclusion criteria was a non-survivable injury. So the primary outcome was 90-day all-cause mortality, and from October 2017 through March 2022, 90 patients were enrolled. However, the trial was actually stopped early due to pre-specified interim analysis for harm. That was met before the planned 120 patients were enrolled. So talking about these patients, 97 of them experienced blunt trauma. But remember, it's a UK study. So most commonly, they saw stabbings compared to shootings. Almost 25% required CPR upon arrival to the ED. And patients in the REBOA treatment arm had a lower median systolic blood pressure. It's about 85 compared to about 100 in that standard care arm. Now, there was no significant difference in the 90-day mortality between the two treatment arms. 54% in the REBOA group compared to 42% in the standard care group. And when you look at those secondary outcomes, REBOA treatment actually increased the risk of death at both 3 and 6 hours, while also reducing the chance that you would get definitive hemorrhage control procedure done. Now, the authors then describe in the supplementary appendix, right, that not all patients actually randomized to placement of the REBOA actually progressed to full balloon occlusion. They state that this was due to a few reasons. Technical failure, right, or inability to achieve arterial access was number one. Patient improvement because of other resuscitative measures, typically blood products. And then number three, patient deterioration during REBOA deployment. So they did 2 post-hoc analyses. The effect of REBOA placement with no technical failure and no change in clinical condition, and the effect of REBOA placement with just simply no technical failure. And they saw no significance in either. So the findings of this UK REBOA JAMA study show that a treatment strategy utilizing REBOA placement in addition to standard care did not reduce mortality, and instead it actually may have increased it. From that start, let's continue our focus on emergency medicine topics. And Haley, let's highlight a newer set of SCCM guidelines featuring multiple pharmacist guideline authors.
Thanks so much, Nick. Yeah, I think this is a really exciting publication, given not only that our first author is a pharmacist, but as well as multiple authors on the guideline being pharmacists. And ultimately, regarding all the highlights of these guidelines, the panel reviewed articles that were published between 2000 and 2020 and created 10 PICO questions using GRADE methodology. Today, we're going to focus mainly on those PICO questions and recommendations involving medications, starting off with our first recommendation surrounding medication-assisted pre-oxygenation. So overall, the panel suggests using medication-assisted pre-oxygenation when patients are not tolerating assisted mask ventilation, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, or high-flow nasal cannula due to either agitation, delirium, or combative behavior, with this being a conditional recommendation, very low quality of evidence. But ultimately, the thought here is really just this use of our delayed sequence RSI, so giving your sedative hypnotic, waiting until your patient is oxygenating appropriately, and then proceeding with neuromuscular blockade and intubation, which I think clinically makes sense given the need for adequate oxygenation prior to RSI. Shifting gears to a different peri-intubation intervention, our next recommendation addresses peri-intubation vasopressors, or as many of us commonly know them as push-dose pressors. And this really aimed to answer the question of if this versus fluid resuscitation alone had any difference in the incidence of hypotension or cardiac arrest. The panel overall concluded that there was insufficient evidence to make a recommendation that there's any difference between the therapies, given that there are no studies directly comparing the two interventions. But ultimately, I think the guidelines make a very important point that if we're going to utilize push-dose pressors, they recommend it be with a provider that's comfortable with the dosing and administration, and that we should be using commercially prepared products in order to reduce the risk of medication errors, such as incorrect dosing. Next up is a recommendation surrounding utilization of induction agents with neuromuscular blockade. And the panel advises administering a sedative hypnotic induction agent when a neuromuscular blocker is used for intubation in our critically ill adults with hemodynamic instability, as well as those with a depressed level of consciousness. So this is an ungraded best practice statement, largely because there's minimal data on patient awareness when neuromuscular blockade is used. Only is used, but given ethical concerns for neuromuscular blockade only RSI, we really should almost always be using an induction agent along with neuromuscular blockade. In regard to the choice of induction agents, the panel suggests that there's no difference between etomidate and other induction agents administered for RSI with respect to mortality or the incidence of hypotension or vasopressor use in the peri-intubation period, and this is a conditional recommendation with moderate quality of evidence. On the topic of etomidate, the next recommendation addresses corticosteroid use when etomidate is used for RSI to counteract the potential adrenal suppression. The panel suggests against administering corticosteroids following RSI with etomidate for the purpose of counteracting etomidate-induced adrenal suppression, with this being a conditional recommendation with low quality of evidence. Given that there's really unclear clinical significance of adrenal suppression, as well as lack of consistent dosing in previous studies and potential selection bias, it really limits our availability to extrapolate this into our current practice, and thus routine use is not recommended. Last but certainly not least, the final two recommendations surround utilization of neuromuscular blockade for RSI, as well as the choice of agent. And the panel recommends administering neuromuscular blockade when a sedative hypnotic induction agent is used for intubation, with this being a strong recommendation with low quality of evidence. This just given that evidence that we have currently shows that utilization of neuromuscular blocking agents is associated with increased first pass success rates, as well as decreased adverse events such as aspiration. And the panel also suggests administering either rocuronium or succinylcholine when there are no known contraindications to succinylcholine as a conditional recommendation with low quality of evidence. And I think this question really comes from the concern for inadequate analgo sedation when rocuronium is used, given its longer duration of action. So in the absence of contraindications, succinylcholine should likely be used. All these recommendations are clinically sound and in line with routine practice, but I think it's really great to have this updated quality guidance for a procedure that pharmacists can play such a heavy role in at the bedside, with the caveat, obviously, that many of these recommendations are conditional and leave a lot of room for research to assist in more definitive answers to these questions in the future.
Yeah, it really stands out that there's only one recommendation, right, that isn't conditional or kind of like a best practice. And the one that was, right, it kind of surprised me actually, because it talks about if you give a sedative, give a neuromuscular blocker. And Haley, you highlighted the evidence around the best practice of the opposite of that, right? That using a neuromuscular blocker and a sedative. And I would have assumed that that was the strong level of evidence. You know, the way you ended it, highlighting the need for future research, right? Completely agree. Lots of areas for pharmacists to help answer these remaining questions. And you make great points about push-dose pressors and the need for a med safety perspective. If you don't have that protocolized and have a process in place, what a problem waiting to happen. And then, like all of these SCCM guidelines, the supplementary appendix are filled with great info. Some of my favorites are they break down each question and then how they determine the strength of the recommendation. So really great. If these guidelines piqued your interest, be sure to stay tuned because possibly, but probably in the works is an episode featuring three of those five pharmacist guideline authors. Now, shifting gears here just a little bit, in my opinion, a candidate for 2023 article, non-research article of the year, Caitlin, highlight this CID publication challenging what we know about antibiotics and treatments of specific infectious diseases.
Yeah, Nick, thanks for that introduction. Really interesting article here. So when I think back to antimicrobial pharmacotherapy class in school, I remember memorizing a lot of antibiotic clinical pearls. And this article was published in an effort to debunk some of those clinical pearls or myths, as the authors refer to them. So this article titled Antibiotic Myths for the Infectious Disease Clinician was published in Clinical Infectious Disease, and it outlines 8 common myths of infectious disease management. Authors were comprised of ID clinicians, including pharmacists, so shout out. With each myth, the authors do a great job describing how it came to be and what evidence is available to support why it's now debunked. I'll encourage listeners to download and read the full article themselves, but I'd like to highlight a few that I found to be some of my favorites. So the first is that clindamycin is first line for prevention of surgical site infections in patients with penicillin allergies. The cross-reactivity rates of penicillin allergies and reactions to first-generation cephalosporins, such as cefazolin, is only 5 to 10%. Interestingly, one study of 690 patients with a reported penicillin allergy who received cefazolin, clindamycin, or vancomycin showed similar rates of hypersensitivity among all three agents. Another consideration is that clindamycin resistance is on the rise for gram-positive infections. And for all of these reasons, updated guidelines suggest that cefazolin is considered a first-line antibiotic choice for surgical prophylaxis in patients with a history of anaphylaxis to penicillin. The next two myths both have to do with linazolid. The first, which shocked me as one of their myths, is that linazolid must be avoided in those on SSRIs. We know that the FDA recommends a 2-week washout in patients on SSRIs and a 5-week washout in patients on fluoxetine specifically prior to receiving linazolid. Interestingly, a review of 4,000 patients on an SSRI treated for gram-positive infections with linazolid or comparator showed that there was a 0.41% incidence of serotonin syndrome in the linazolid group and a 0.14% incidence in the comparator group. So in general, not a high risk of serotonin syndrome in the patients on linazolid. Authors conclude that we should be considering the risk versus benefit of utilizing linazolid in patients on SSRIs. However, this is not a clear-cut contraindication to linazolid treatment. That being said, if patients are treated with linazolid and are on an SSRI concomitantly, patients should still be monitored for signs and symptoms of serotonin syndrome. The next linazolid myth is that there's no need to adjust dosing in renal impaired patients. Recent evidence has shown that patients with renal dysfunction were more likely to experience linazolid-induced thrombocytopenia than those with, quote, normal renal function. Because of this, experts suggest adjusting linazolid to 300 milligrams IV or PO every 12 hours in those with a GFR of less than 60 mils per minute to reduce the risk of thrombocytopenia occurrence. Another one of my favorite myths the article describes is that doxycycline is contraindicated in pregnancy and pediatric patients under 8 years old. I was really surprised to see this in the article because it's one of those classic clinical pearls that we hear about, that using doxy in peds patients is going to cause tooth discoloration. And the authors don't disagree with this fact, but they do provide convincing evidence for when we should and can consider using doxy in pregnant and pediatric patients. And the American Academy of Pediatrics states the short course of doxy, which they define as 21 days or less, is acceptable due to minimal risk of dental staining. Authors conclude that in cases of severe infections without equivalent efficacious treatment alternatives, such as rickettsial diseases, the benefit of doxycycline use may outweigh the risk. And the other four myths in the article are equally as surprising. These authors did a great job providing evidence for reasons why these myths are debunked, and I highly encourage listeners to read this article and try and remove some of those clinical pearls that have been embedded in our brains since pharmacy school. Nick, what were some of your favorite myths from the article?
So I think my favorite is definitely the rifampin and aminoglycoside are necessary for prosthetic valve endocarditis treatment myth. The routine use of aminoglycosides for synergy, especially for endocarditis. Let's stop that madness. This is a really, really, really good article. You know, you mentioned, I was thinking about it as you were talking through this, you know, great highlight of some of these key points. And I almost wonder, you know, do we have all these pearls just to make it easier to remember? Because how hard is ID, right? When you're a student, you're like dreading it, right? It's the worst. It's like, if you're power ranking, it's like ID cards and everything else, right? And so maybe that's why, but maybe we're just emphasizing the wrong things possibly. And then, man, all these things with linazolid, nothing is safe. We can't, there, nothing is easy is what that takeaway was. You know, you highlighted it, two pharmacists, first author, guest on the Mercy Trial Rapid Reaction episode, Aaron McCreary, and then senior author, Jason Gallagher, two ID pharmacist extraordinaires. And then I'd be remiss not to shout out, so Aaron is the co-host of the SIDP podcast Breakpoints. They have a full episode going into detail on this paper, right? And it's called Who You Gonna Call Mythbusters? And of course, Antibiotic Myths for the Infectious Diseases Clinicians. So be sure to listen to that. Awesome, awesome stuff. I think it's going to take a great trial to follow these two that Haley and Caitlin just talked about. Some would say legendary or even iconic. And that is precisely what we have in this AJR CCM research study comparing conservative versus liberal oxygenation targets in ICU patients, aka, you guessed it, the iconic RCT. So, international parallel group randomized controlled trial in the Netherlands and Italy. So they enrolled adult patients expected to require mechanical ventilation for 24 hours or longer. Key exclusion criteria, a lot were disease states that could confound these study results, right? So severe ARDS, exacerbation of COPD, cardiogenic shock, anemia, things like that. So patients were randomized to a low oxygenation target, targeting a PaO2 between 55 and 80, and a high oxygenation group targeting between 110 and 150 millimeters of mercury. Now, you could also use SpO2. The target for the lower range was 91 to 94, with 97 to 100 being the higher range target. Now, the primary outcome was 28-day all-cause mortality. And from November 2018 through November 2021, 882 patients met inclusion criteria with deferred informed consent ultimately available for 664 of those patients. So groups are well-balanced, right? Primarily medical ICU patients. Surprisingly, the most common reason for ICU admission was cardiac arrest. So that definitely stood out in baseline characteristics. No difference in the primary outcome of 28-day all-cause mortality, but both groups had a higher rate than they initially expected. So the mortality rate was between 35 to 40% in both groups. And they estimated mortality before as like they were calculating. The sample size was about 24%. And that was actually now, you take that in effect with the fact that the study was actually stopped early after about 40% of patients were enrolled. I know, 40-40. So now it was stopped early due to decreased recruitment and increased workload in the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic. So, right, did we get it where you had the early phase, more mortality in the beginning part? But that's a pretty big increase. So the researchers didn't find any differences in secondary outcomes, subgroup analyses, anything like that. I think the only remaining question kind of for me is why 28 days compared to what we see kind of that more standard now, which is 90 days. But regardless, I think this is in line with previous RCTs like the ANZICS ICU ROCK study and the Vanderbilt Pragmatic Critical Care Research Group pilot trial, which showed showed no reduction in mortality or ventilator free days with a higher oxygen target in that general ICU adult population. So with one of the most fun study acronyms of the episode, Haley, let's talk about a trial researching a common delirium treatment with a unique research outcome.
Yeah, thanks so much, Nick. As we all know, there's no shortage of delirium-related research. We have our MIND-USA and AID-ICU trials that found haloperidol to be ineffective in reducing delirium duration, with our MIND-USA looking at haloperidol or ziprasidone versus placebo and its effect on duration of delirium, ultimately finding no difference there, as well as AID-ICU looking at haloperidol versus placebo and its effect on number of days alive, ultimately also finding no difference. But neither trial evaluated key delirium endpoints, such as agitation-related complications or the occurrence of psychotic symptoms, which is usually what we're targeting with haloperidol therapy. So this trial differs from prior trials because it specifically assessed delirium outcomes related to agitation, and this is the efficacy of haloperidol to decrease the burden of delirium in adult critically ill patients, also known as the Euridis trial, published in Critical Care. This trial aimed to determine whether haloperidol compared to placebo in our critically ill adults with delirium reduces days with delirium and coma and improves delirium-related complications, with their primary outcome being ICU delirium and coma-free days within 14 days of randomization. This was a multi-center, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial at 8 mixed medical and surgical ICUs in the Netherlands between February 2018 and January 2020. They included critically ill adults with delirium based on the intensive care delirium screening checklist or a positive CAM ICU score. And key exclusion criteria included admission to the ICU for primary acute neurologic condition, those who had already received haloperidol in the ICU, had a history of ventricular arrhythmias, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, Parkinsonism, schizophrenia, or other psychotic disorders, or had dementia or an expected duration of ICU admission to be less than 24 hours. Patients were randomized to receive IV haloperidol 2.5 milligrams or placebo every 8 hours and could be up titrated to 5 milligrams every 8 hours if delirium persisted. And of note, the study drug could be restarted within the 14-day intervention period if delirium reoccurred. They aim to include over 700 patients to provide a 90% power in order to detect a one-day difference in delirium and coma-free days. But looking at their baseline characteristics, they had a mean age of 64 years, and the majority of these patients were male medical ICU patients with a mean SOFA score of about 5, equating to moderate severity of illness. They could utilize additional rescue medications for agitation and delirium in each group, and the most common ones included atypical antipsychotics, clonidine, dexmedetomidine, and benzodiazepine, which I think likely represents similar clinical practice to what we see day to day. And the authors did highly discourage open label haloperidol use. Looking at their results, the median number of delirium and coma-free days was 9 in both groups and not significantly different, even after adjusting for possible confounders. However, they did find that in patients treated with haloperidol versus placebo were less likely to receive benzodiazepines, and this was statistically significantly different. Important to point out here, this trial was terminated prematurely for primary endpoint futility based on advice after enrollment of just 132 patients. They also looked at secondary outcomes related to agitation that showed no statistically significant difference with haloperidol treatment, as well as safety outcomes addressing adverse drug events. And they found that there was no difference between the groups, but the haloperidol group did have a significantly lower systolic and diastolic blood pressures. The authors overall concluded that haloperidol does not reduce delirium in our critically ill adults, but may reduce rescue medications in these ICU patients, warranting further evaluation. And I did also want to point out that consent in this study was different from other studies. They used written informed consent as opposed to deferred consent, which overall contributed to their low enrollment and the subsequently lower sample size. However, nonetheless, our clinical takeaway here is that haloperidol appears to be a safe option for agitation management in our critically ill adults with mixed and agitated delirium and could potentially decrease the need for utilization of benzodiazepines. But I think our choice of agent should always be based on patient-specific presentation and risk factors. But these results are in line with our larger randomized control trial findings as well, despite this trial looking at specific outcomes not assessed in the other RCTs.
Yeah, shout out a third author and pharmacist John Devlin, you know, one of the most influential researchers in the field of delirium. Haley, great highlight, great points. I think two things that also stood out to me. Adverse effects were not different, right, between that haloperidol and placebo treatment arms. And kind of that hypothesis-generating notion that patients receiving haloperidol treatment had a significant increase in that mean dose of opioids they received in the 24-hour period. So one of the things that stands out is the tracking of patient and family member well-being, burden of illness, and PTSD when looking at long-term outcomes. When thinking about patient and family-centered care, right, this is certainly one of those things that would be at the heart of it. And the supplementary appendix goes into the details and the results. Definitely, I'm sure, more to come there. Great research from the Eurodis study team. Now, when a surgeon wants or asks you for something, they mean now, right? Immediately. They probably make the joke they wanted it yesterday. So, Caitlin, highlight this appropriately named study looking at antimicrobial coverage in orthopedic surgery.
Absolutely. So this study hits home for me as I'm rotating through the surgical ICU right now. So I can absolutely relate to surgeons wanting what they want when they want it. So the Australian Surgical Antibiotic Prophylaxis Trial, or the ASAP trial, was published in New England Journal of Medicine. Postoperative infections result in high patient morbidity, mortality, and healthcare costs. And currently, the IDSA guidelines recommend administration of a first or second generation cephalosporin at the time of arthroplasty or joint replacement. Early generation cephalosporins, however, would not cover patients for MRSA infections, and unfortunately, post-arthroplasty MRSA surgical site infections have reportedly been on the rise. Due to this, many Australian hospitals have adopted the use of cefazolin plus vancomycin to their regimen for surgical site infection prophylaxis. There isn't much evidence available examining the benefit and/or the harm of additional coverage with vancomycin for this patient population. So authors of this trial sought to determine whether the addition of vancomycin to cefazolin for patients undergoing knee, hip, and/or shoulder replacement had any benefit in terms of surgical site infection incidence. This was an Australian multi-center double-blind parallel group superiority placebo-controlled trial. Patients without known MRSA colonization who were scheduled to undergo arthroplasty were randomized to either vancomycin 1.5 grams or normal saline given within 120 minutes of surgical incision. Patients in both groups also received cefazolin 2 grams prior to their procedure. The primary outcome examined was surgical site infection within 90 days after surgery, following the CDC definition of surgical site infection. 4,239 patients were randomized between January 2019 and October 2021, and of those, 4,113 patients were included in the modified intention-to-treat population. Baseline characteristics were similar between treatment arms, with most patients undergoing knee or hip arthroplasty, and the authors note that this is consistent with data reported by national and international registries. There was no statistically significant differences in rates of surgical site infections, the primary outcome, between the vancomycin and placebo groups, with 4% of patients in the entire cohort experiencing a surgical site infection. Only 40% of those experiencing an infection had bacteria isolated, and Staph aureus was the most common isolate, with almost all of those being MSSA. Adverse effects, which primarily included hypersensitivity and AKI, occurred in 1.7% of patients in both groups, and interestingly, a higher percentage of patients in the placebo group than the vancomycin group had stage 2 or stage 3 AKI. Table 2 in the article outlines more information regarding infections that occurred and safety endpoints, and figure 2 is a forest plot of the subgroup populations in the study. This study just missed their pre-specified power. However, they enrolled 98% of their planned sample size, so it's unlikely that outcomes would have been different. In the future, I'd love to see a study done with U.S. patients and maybe consider including those colonized with MRSA or those who have a history of an MRSA infection. Based on the results of this trial, it seems that those undergoing arthroplasty who are not colonized with MRSA, cefazolin alone is appropriate for surgical prophylaxis.
You know, it's an important trial when the New England Journal of Medicine has an infographic released along with the publication of the full text PDF, and the ASAP trial does just that. Now, when you read this text, it's defined as a phase 4 trial. So I had to look up what this meant, so I figured I'd take a couple notes for some listeners, right? So phase 4, the researchers were studying the effect of this intervention, the antibiotic treatment in this case, and the side effects caused by the antibiotic used, right? So in this case, surgical site infection. And I think with the increase in antimicrobial resistance, like Caitlin did a really good job of highlighting, I think the theory is that the broader antibiotic would improve outcomes, right? Everything we're seeing is resistance and patterns are getting worse in all these different areas. And that was certainly not the case. So tremendous data and research regardless here. Now, how could we have our seven-nation army of featured articles and not discuss sepsis once? So rounding out this section is a JAMA article discussing the use of a very common medication in our patients with septic shock. So we've highlighted on previous episodes with multiple guests how challenging it is to manage vasopressor-induced arrhythmias and tachycardia. And a 2013 Italian single-center study in septic shock patients actually found that IV esmolol reduced that heart rate without an increase in adverse effects. Not that exciting, right? Why are we talking about this? What they also found was that it significantly reduced mortality. Of course, that gets us excited. Now, keep in mind, the one thing I want to note here, the control arm had a mortality rate of 80%. So the validity of these patients, the patients that we treat, unclear. But the UK research team appropriately took these findings as hypothesis generating and created the STRESS-L study looking at the use of landiolol in septic shock. Now, before we get into the study itself, right, what is landiolol? Brand name Rapiblock, which is a great brand name. But similar to IV esmolol, a rapid-acting beta blocker, 8 times more selective for beta-1 receptors compared to esmolol. And you titrate by 1 mg/kg/min every 15 minutes, a dose range of 1 to 40 mg/kg/min. It's been approved for use for a while in Japan since 2002. It's approved for use in the EU, not here in the US just yet. Now, this is a UK multi-center, open-label, unblinded, phase 2 randomized controlled trial. Now, investigator-initiated trial with grant funding. So although the drug was provided without cost, that was the only role of the pharmaceutical company. I feel like that's important to note. Now, adult ICU patients with septic shock via that sepsis 3 criteria, they were on norepinephrine for a dose of at least 0.1 mics per kilo per minute and had concomitant tachycardia defined as a heart rate greater than 95 beats per minute. Key exclusion criteria, pre-existing severe cardiac and pulmonary disease. And patients were randomized to either standard care, the control group, or landiolol treatment plus standard care, right? The intervention arm. There was no comparator or blinding, right? Because the infusion was titrated to a target heart rate of 80 to 94 beats per minute. They wanted to reach that goal within 6 hours of drug initiation. And then that landiolol infusion was down titrated to off once vasopressors were off for at least 12 hours. And the primary outcome was the mean SOFA score over 14 days from enrollment while in the ICU. So from April 2018 through December 2021, 126 patients with some similar baseline characteristics were recruited, had a notable pause of a few months due to COVID in 2020. A quick note on those numbers, right? That's a big time frame for only 126 patients. So only 8% of the screened patients were eligible, and only a third of those gave informed written consent. So keep that in mind. And there was no difference in that 14-day mean SOFA score between the intervention and comparator arm. The 28-day mortality was numerically higher in that treatment arm of 37% compared to 25%, but did not reach statistical significance. Now, from a safety perspective as well, more patients in the intervention arm had at least one serious adverse event, and patients receiving landiolol treatment required a higher norepinephrine infusion rate. So the slow enrollment, the lack of an improvement in that outcome, and the safety signal of possibly mortality and increased adverse effects, the Data Monitoring Committee prematurely ended the trial because not only was it unlikely to demonstrate benefit, but there was the possibility of harm. So was one of the first studies looking at the effect of beta blocker treatment on organ failure in septic shock. And unfortunately, along with their heart rate, our expectations were reduced as well. But no reducing here. What a great featured article section. Now the discussion shifts to the top in a head-to-toe overview. And Haley leads off our discussion with a study from pharmacist researchers that took the neurocritical care world by storm when it was published, featuring everyone's favorite drug, of course, ketamine.
So I think this is one of my favorite articles in the section, really adding to the literature of what ketamine can do, along with the fact that it is a first pharmacist author on this publication as well. This is the safety and efficacy of ketamine without intubation in the management of refractory seizures. This is a single center retrospective case series published in Neurocritical Care in adult patients admitted to the NCCU with refractory status epilepticus, defined as failure to respond to first and second line agents. Their primary objective was to assess response to ketamine, which they defined as patients with documentation of resolution of seizures within 24 hours of initiation and without the need for intubation or additional continuous infusion anesthetics. They researched it this way as a means to preserve respiratory drive and potentially prevent intubation in this patient population. They included 28 patients, with the majority experiencing focal seizures due to structural epilepsy, and found that 71.4% were assessed to be ketamine responders, with seizure cessation being faster at 7.3 hours in the ketamine group versus 35.5 hours. And while not a statistically significant finding, they did see that responders were started on ketamine about 16 hours sooner than the non-responders. More than 70% of patients received an initial bolus dose of 1 mg/kg, followed by a continuous infusion ranging from 5 to 30 mics per kilo per minute, so a pretty wide range there of dosing, and overall concluded that early initiation of ketamine appears to be a safe option and may potentially reduce morbidity associated with intubation and mechanical ventilation in certain patients, but larger trials are warranted to assess ideal timing of initiation as well as our optimal dosing strategies. So I think this is a really great addition to the literature, since it's one of our only descriptive studies for ketamine in this specific indication and could be really helpful for this patient population.
There may be some skeptics listening and thinking to themselves, okay, 28 patients. Just want to set the stage, right? Remember, in the world of refractory status and seizure treatment, systematic reviews include conference abstracts. So that's like where we are in the data world with this. So 28 patients is actually a decent amount. That I wouldn't say the data is abundant on this topic. And what we love that our pharmacist colleagues from Methodist Houston did, they tried to characterize and define those differences between the responders and non-responders, help predict who we should be using this medication in, because if your all's institution is like anything like I've had to deal with, I feel like it's 1 month you have ketamine, 3 months it's on shortage. You know, like, what is it, the 30 days past September, April, June, and November? I feel like those are the months that we have ketamine and every other month is unavailable. So, you know, if we have this awesome drug and we know who we're using it in, can preserve it, and maybe we get 5 months instead of the four. But yeah, I completely agree. Awesome, awesome study. And I think this was even a Neurocritical Care Pharmacy Journal Club at one point on the X or Twitter, whatever it's called. So definitely something that moved the page in the pharmacy world there. Well, let's kind of stay in the seizure realm. And Ji Lu highlighted his NCS research abstract looking into validating a new equation for estimating free valproic acid concentrations in a 2023 NCS research highlight episode. And that same study was published in Critical Care Exploration. So I had to give a shout out and just quick reminder, right? Retrospective multi-site study that had a derivation and validation cohort in patients with a free and total VPA level from 2014 to August 2022. So they created kind of that new equation. It had a low risk of bias, but it was considered to be imprecise. So more research is needed. We'll likely see more with this equation, but really cool to see this full text of this research. And then, of course, want to be sure and highlight table one. That shows the different available equations to estimate free VPA levels from total levels, some of the, you know, the references as to where those came from. So if you're in the neuro world, that's definitely one to save all those references, get an idea for some of those equations. Now, when discussing hemodynamic targets, I think it's frequently pointed out that the goal range compared to patients' actual values aren't always the same. So, Haley, review this study researching a similar question in a neurocritical care population.
Thanks, Nick. So as I'm sure most of us know, there's a whole lot of controversy surrounding blood pressure goals and ICH, as well as some prior conflicting guideline recommendations on SBP targets and lower limit thresholds. So I think it remains a really important question as to what our optimal goal SBP range is in these ICH patients. So this is the adherence to established blood pressure targets and associated complications in patients presenting with acute intracerebral hemorrhage, which is a retrospective multicenter single health system cohort study published out of neurocritical care in our adults admitted to the NCCU with spontaneous ICH. Their primary objective was to evaluate the frequency of time spent within their target SBP range, which they defined as 140 to 160 in the first 48 hours after diagnosis. They included 80 patients and found that the majority of these patients actually spent more time below the target SBP range in the first 48 hours, with 54% of patients being below a systolic of 140. They found that hypotension was associated with renal adverse events, and then a further analysis found that patients who had more than 20% relative SBP reduction in those first 48 hours experienced more renal adverse events, brain ischemia, and increased odds of decreased functional outcomes at discharge. Authors overall concluded that intensive SBP reduction following ICH predisposes these patients to secondary organ injury that may impact long-term outcomes, and potentially a more modest lowering of the SBP within 48 hours may minimize the risk of further adverse events. And I think this is really similar to and kind of strengthens our 2022 ICH guideline recommendations for smooth blood pressure control with lack of variability and hypotension, possibly relating to improved patient outcomes.
Yeah, you said it. That's exactly right. This, you know, retrospective evidence from the pharmacist researchers in Pennsylvania, it's in line with not only our guidelines, but those larger RCT findings, which make these certainly seem more feasible when this retrospective stuff's in line with the bigger studies. And, making sure your blood pressure doesn't go too low, you know, that might be the debate. It certainly seems as much, if not more important than ensuring your blood pressure doesn't go too high, right? This is more evidence that low is bad in these patients. Wow. So Haley, what an incredible neuro article month here. And close us out talking about a review, because we've had more and more research into anticoagulation reversal and hemostatic pharmacotherapy in the last few years. Discuss that Cochrane systematic review researching those agents' use in spontaneous ICH patients, and did any of those recommendations change?
Yeah, so we know that preventing hematoma expansion in these spontaneous ICH patients is really a priority in their care. Hemostatic therapies such as recombinant factor 7A or usually Novo 7, tranexamic acid, possibly DDAVP can help prevent or decrease hematoma expansion, but they can also carry potential thrombosis risk. And so currently our 2022 ICH guidelines state that effectiveness of hemostatic treatment is unclear for all of these agents, and they do not make a recommendation for or against utilization in practice. And so this Cochrane review was last updated in 2018, and it currently looked at 20 randomized control trials comparing hemostatic treatments and effects on outcomes in these patients, specifically looking at death and dependence at day 90. So most of their data looked at factor 7, which we don't routinely use in practice. And I think the evidence really supports this, given that there has been no proven difference in death or ICH expansion, which also applies to our antifibrinolytic drugs, though this review did find that antifibrinolytics may result in a slight reduction in ICH expansion within 24 hours, but this was not associated with improved patient outcomes. And there's even less high quality evidence when they look at RCTs surrounding PCC versus FFP. And overall, I think this Cochrane review really helps solidify the general decision to not routinely use these agents in practice. However, there are 13 randomized control trials in process that may help answer the question of the true effect of hemostatic therapies on patient outcomes with spontaneous ICH.
Yeah, this review really highlights just the lack of what you'd call high quality data with these hemostatic agents, right? And how a lot of what we're doing is based on characteristics and retrospective observational data. So not great data, hopefully tons more to come on the horizon with highlighting 13 studies, certainly, you know, we're still waiting for the Anexa I study, those amazing results. So that's probably one and more of those. So excited to see how those study results impact our care over those next few years. And rounding out our Lost in My Mind section, focusing on those neuro-related articles, is a study from pharmacists in Ann Arbor, Michigan, published in the Journal of Pharmacy Practice. Now, sedation practices, they have changed, right? Emphasizing non-benzodiazepine sedative use, primary driver of this switch being in a reduction of delirium. Most of us know this, right? So the authors theorize that the rate of delirium should be reduced if the use of benzodiazepines as sedative in a unit is reduced as well. So a 4-year retrospective study in a MICU population, and the primary outcome was the association between annual cumulative benzodiazepine use and the incidence of delirium during the study period, right, that they tracked via KMICU score. And in over 5,000 patients, despite a large significant reduction in benzodiazepine use and a large significant increase in dexmedetomidine use, right, the two essentially evening each other out, there was no difference in the rate of delirium. But a multivariate analysis found only dexmedetomidine from a sedative or analgesic perspective wasn't associated with the development of delirium. So I think this highlights delirium research is hard, right? We talked about the Uridis study earlier, highlighting this now. And are there other modifiable risk factors, right? Are we identifying every patient? I think this is one of those where more questions may remain than answers, but really good, great kind of research hypothesis execution, and likely more things to come. Now, our next section, we're going to have we call it a potpourri of sorts, but it's kind of a targeted potpourri, emergency medicine, toxicology, trauma, right? They're all kind of in the same class here. So we're going to combine them all for an awesome section. And we're going to kick off the discussion researching a treatment most commonly used in nutrition and toxicology. What? Caitlin, take it away.
I found this article to be really interesting. It was published in Clinical Toxicology and is titled Lipid Emulsion Therapy During Management of the Critically Ill Poison Patient. When an antidote is unavailable in a poisoning situation, IV lipid emulsion have been used as potential treatment options. The proposed mechanism is administering IV lipids to create a lipid sink, which would draw lipophilic medications out of the tissue to limit toxicities from occurring. This U.S. multicenter prospective cohort study sought to determine survival rates in patients who received IV lipids stratified by the intoxicant's lipophilicity. 134 patients treated by a medical toxicologist were enrolled, and Table 2 in the article outlines which agents were ingested prior to lipid treatment. The study broke patients up into two groups based on lipophilicity, and interestingly, lipophilicity was not correlated with survival or changes in blood pressure, with 80% of the study cohort surviving. The results of this trial surprised me. Authors conclude that the benefits of intravenous lipid were unrelated to the lipid sink. The question now is that if intoxicant lipophilicity did not correlate with better survival rates, should we consider anecdotal lipid emulsion for more overdose situations and even agents that aren't lipophilic? This is a really interesting study and had me questioning everything I thought I knew about anecdotal lipid emulsion.
I love that you took it that way, because I think the other side could be, do lipids do anything? Right. And so I think the two, you're at the pathway where you have this idea. And I think the question is, should we try to do them in more patients and see a difference? Or is this mechanism of action, do we maybe not see it as much? Is there maybe not as big of an effect as we might think? I mean, the researchers note that although the blood pressure increased with the IV lipid emulsions, right, that IV vasopressors were administered at the same time, right, simultaneously. So in this type of study, and this research in general in this toxicology critically ill world is really hard. But it's kind of hard to say which one of those, right? Kind of the chicken or the egg scenario, the lipids versus the vasopressors. But incredibly hypothesis generating. And I thought this group, despite how challenging it can be, complete that research in this population. I thought they did fantastic job completing this retrospective multi-center study. So I'm sure this isn't the last we're going to be thinking about and looking at IV lipids in this patient. Now, if you practice in the ED, you've probably been affected by the inability to get IV physostigmine, especially in the case of anticholinergic toxicity. And we're going to stay in the tox world here. And Caitlin, highlight this case report on the use of an alternative pharmacologic treatment in these scenarios.
Absolutely. So our next article is a creative case report titled Oral and Transdermal Rivastigmine for the Treatment of Anticholinergic Delirium. It was published in the Journal of Emergency Medicine and describes the case of a 61-year-old woman who presented to the ED with signs and symptoms consistent with anticholinergic toxicity. Rather than the standard antidote, physostigmine, this patient received two doses of rivastigmine, 3 milligrams via NG tube. Following the second dose, she was alert and oriented, and rivastigmine 13.3 milligrams as a patch was subsequently applied. The consulting psychiatrist deemed she was back to her baseline mental status 27 hours after the initial rivastigmine administration per NG tube. This is a really interesting case and is especially important considering that physostigmine is on national shortage at this time. Rivastigmine also provides an enteral and transdermal dosage form and is more cost-effective than physostigmine. So great job from these authors from Pittsburgh thinking outside the box to overcome drug shortages.
Yeah, and they use those rivastigmine IR capsules for acute management. And I think that's an important note because, right, there's no parenteral route of administration for this. So they were able to safely do it via NG. I also love that the authors described when they administered these therapies on a timeline. So, you shouted them out for this great research. I'll shout them out from our fellow pharmacists have given us a little timetable and things. So some evidence, right, that you may have had to or thought about using alternative treatment with rivastigmine, but not only is it safe, but likely effective. So great kind of case report highlighting there from the tox and EM world. Switching gears just a little bit here, right? This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. So much of the literature on bleeding outcomes in patients receiving anticoagulation are in a primarily trauma patient population. And the EAST Multicenter Research Group wanted to identify the effect of DOAC use in EGS or emergency general surgery patients. So they created a greatly named the ACES study, published in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery. So prospective multicenter observational trial enrolled patients from June 2019 through January 2022. And patients were enrolled if they took their last DOAC, vitamin K antagonist, or antiplatelet dose within 24 hours of an intervention. Probably wondering, I couldn't figure out how we verified that. So that's one kind of outstanding note from that perspective. But they compared bleeding outcomes when taking DOACs compared to vitamin K antagonists or antiplatelets. So there were also some differences between the groups, notably that more patients receiving DOACs got reversal agents, specifically PCC. If you actually think about it, that makes sense, right? In the setting of you have an INR for your vitamin K antagonist, you don't really have that in a lot of these centers for DOACs. But the use of DOACs was not associated with an increase in perioperative bleeding complications compared to the use of warfarin or antiplatelet therapy. And ultimately, what the researchers found was that the EGS procedure, the patient's severity of illness, and past medical history play a bigger role in predicting the risk of perioperative bleeding and mortality. So things like receiving chemotherapy, presence of intestinal ischemia, history of CHF or CKD, those sorts of things predict a worse outcome than necessarily getting a DOAC or a specific anticoagulant. That could be surprising, but larger studies, they show that DOACs have a similar or reduced risk of bleeding, albeit in a different patient population. I'd say what I was most surprised about in this cohort, 2/3 of those patients were taking vitamin K antagonists compared to DOACs in that group, which I would have thought would maybe be a little closer to. So, but a great study highlighting the effect of DOACs in our EGS patient population. So Cher asked the question, do you believe in life after love? But Caitlin is going to ask a better question. Do you believe in life after CPR has stopped?
Oh, I love the Cher shout out. That was phenomenal. So this article is appropriately titled From Flatline to Lifeline, a scoping review of the Lazarus phenomenon, and was published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine. The article reviews characteristics of Lazarus phenomenon, also known as autoROSC, which is return of spontaneous circulation after the termination of CPR. This phenomenon is thought to be rare, but recent evidence suggests that it may be underreported. This review includes 66 studies between 1982, which is the first year that Lazarus phenomenon was reported, and 2022. Table 1 in the article provides a lot of detailed information regarding patient characteristics, including the type of rhythm, in-hospital or out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and which drugs were administered. Some potential causes of Lazarus phenomenon include lung hyperinflation, dislodgement of an embolus during chest compressions, delayed effects of medications administered via peripheral lines during ACLS, and hyperkalemia. Unfortunately, pathophysiology of Lazarus phenomenon is still not fully understood. The increasing reports describing Lazarus phenomenon or autoROSC necessitate awareness and training on termination of CPR and monitoring patients afterwards. Previously, experts recommended monitoring patients for at least 10 minutes after termination of resuscitation efforts, but based on their review, these authors suggest increasing this time frame to 30 minutes. So to wrap things up, Lazarus phenomenon or autoROSC has been reported in a variety of both cardiac and respiratory arrest situations. Clinicians should be aware of this phenomenon and monitor patients appropriately even after cessation of CPR. Now, this isn't anything that I've seen in practice. Nick, have you seen this in practice before?
I've never seen this in practice. I think it's something you hear about, but with the researchers recommending to wait to pronounce death until 30 minutes after CPR is terminated, maybe that's why. Because 30 minutes is much, much longer than what I'm used to seeing. But that was a fascinating and interesting article. For the record, the listeners, Caitlin chose this, and this was going to be one that I highlighted as well. I thought it was so good. Have to talk about autoROSC, and you're exactly right. Anytime we can toss a Cher reference in here, let's go. I feel like that's a successful article review. And building off, kind of closing out our Let It Bleed EM trauma toxicology section, had a recent immunotherapy part 2 episode featuring Matt McKenzie, and building off of that idea, that concept, this anesthesiology review article looks into the antiplatelet and wound healing implications in the perioperative period from immunotherapy. Now, the authors from Salt Lake City with two pharmacists, they highlight mechanism of action and management strategies to handle the hematologic and wound healing effects from the various immunotherapy agents in that perioperative period. So the narrative review, it goes into detail on the effects with the specific agents, but the authors are looking out for us, and they created a beautiful table, table 1, summarizing the effect of immunotherapy on perioperative hematologic and wound healing implications. You'll be seeing more and more of patients receiving these agents, so definitely get familiar. Feels very, very zip drive worthy. Now, we've got a new section on the literature review series, and we've highlighted individual renal and endocrine articles, but I don't believe that they've had their own section until now. Now, the concept of augmented renal clearance is likely not a new one. However, identification of that augmented renal clearance could be. And researchers from the Ohio State University in Columbus published their research, which developed an 8-hour urine collection program for the identification of augmented renal clearance, along with creating a medication dosing protocol. So the authors note that they utilized the Plan, Do, Study, Act approach. that four-phase kind of acronym. If you're a listener that frequently listens to the Literature Review series, this is a approach that we've talked about before. It's been highlighted in other studies. And I like that the researchers show they started this work all the way back in 2017 and how long it can take to really have a safe and effective way of implementation of these things. So the pharmacy team worked with the lab, reviewed the literature, course worked with key stakeholders and committees to gain their approval before they educated those appropriate multidisciplinary team members. Special shout out to figure 1 and 2, which describes their approach and shares their algorithm for treatment. And then table 1 even lists their dosing protocol and augmented renal clearance. So encourage all the listeners to check out this JACCP article for yourself. So I think it's a great example on using this approach to make changes at your institution. How could we have an endocrine section and not talk about every endocrinologist's favorite sodium disorders? And we have not one, but 2 articles, both focusing on the rate of sodium correction. So let's start with hypo, and we're going to finish with hypernatremia. And so from a hyponatremia perspective, this retrospective study from Boston researchers was published in the Journal of Critical Care, and it researches the rate of sodium correction in hyponatremia, specifically patients who had a sodium less than or equal to 120, and that effect on in-hospital mortality. So they defined slow correction as less than or equal to 8 milliequivalents per day, and rapid defined as greater than 8. Now you may be thinking like me, wait a second, I thought that cutoff was 12, right? Or 0.5 an hour. So this cutoff was chosen by researchers because it falls within the correction range and gives leeway in case a patient may have chronic hyponatremia that you're unaware of and you're acutely managing it. So keep that in mind, that 8 versus 12. So this cohort was a database study over 200 hospitals, 2014 through 2015. They ended up including just over 1,000 patients. And rapid correction reduced in-hospital mortality even after adjusting for confounders. Now, one of the things I'd like to see, since the number could possibly be up for debate as to which one you would think would be rapid or not, I'd have liked to see the actual increase in sodium rather than just the binary classification of this group was greater than or equal to 8, this group was less than 8. So, you know, we know limitations with some of those retrospective registry studies, but I think it's a start. I think this is going to certainly set the foundation for looking at this further. Keeping in mind, if you think about it, doing research in the world of sodium and sodium disorders is so challenging because of all the possible confounders. So we always go low to high here, right? We're going to end on a high point. And the JAMA Network Open article is looking at hypernatremia. So it's a retrospective single study taking place in Tel Aviv, researching patients with hypernatremia defined as a sodium greater than or equal to 155. So in this study, their correction rate is similar to what we're used to. Correction rate being defined as greater than 0.5 an hour, which correlates to that 12 milliequivalents per day, and slow being less than or equal to 0.5. Now, 30-day all-cause mortality was the primary outcome, and rapid correction actually significantly reduced this outcome, as well as one-year mortality. Now, just 2 notes here I want to point out. The slow group corrected at a rate of about 10% of the rapid group, 0.83 compared to like 0.087, I believe. And the two groups weren't necessarily well-balanced at baseline. So, again, retrospective in nature and things, but I think it's the foundation for future research into sodium correction, both hypo and hypernatremia, and seeing what is the true number. Is it 12, 0.5 an hour, what have you? And of course, we have our favorite section featuring articles voted on by you, the listeners, in our pharmacist featured article section, aka the front of the fridge. Now, our winner of Vote 1 features a familiar friend of the pod, first author, Brian Gilbert, with an awesome pharmacy research team published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine. What are we waiting for? A review of early basal insulin therapy in DKA management. And this is a review that I like because it gets right to the point. It highlights the discrepancy in guidelines, how long it's been since the ADA ones have been updated compared to our European colleagues. And Table 1 features 5 articles evaluating the use of basal insulin in DKA. For our visual learners, Figure 1 is awesome. It's a beautiful graphic on how each guideline recommends introducing basal insulin into the treatment and kind of shows the big discrepancy between our two governing bodies. But then, of course, not only showing that discrepancy, the authors went ahead and showed you how you could implement this in your protocol using basal insulin, where it would flow in the management. So this article highlights some great benefits with early basal insulin DKA, and it kind of challenges that mantra I think that a lot of us were taught, that you always hold your home insulin in one of our hyperglycemic emergencies. Now, the winner of article vote 2 will be familiar to most of our SECM CPP members. Published in Critical Care Explorations, this is the 2022 major publications in the critical care pharmacotherapy literature. So SECM members, one of the biggest benefits is the CCPLU, and this is essentially the highlight of the highlights. So a multidisciplinary author group, multiple friends of the pod, Brooke Barlow, shout out to Dr. Ashish Khanna on the paper, Kat Spisano, Patrick V. Ruszewski, and so much more. So ultimately, the group highlighted 3 RCTs as well as 3 systematic reviews and meta-analyses. So they review articles that cover topics in ID, sepsis, PADIS, VTE prophylaxis. I don't want to spoil the articles they review, so everyone go download that 2022 CCPLU major publication review, and that's published in Critical Care Explorations. And closing out our pharmacist-featured articles, and the winner of Vote 3 is a JACCP article from our pharmacist colleagues in California entitled Creation and Execution of an Effective Critical Care Pharmacist Collaborative in an Academic Health System. And it's a narrative review going into the details of this ICU pharmacist collaborative, right? How it was formed, how they conducted meetings, how did they conduct research ideas, how they executed them. I mean, anyone looking to do this, table 1 of this article is for you. It not only describes the essential elements for a pharmacist collaborative, it also gives examples of each element, describes its purpose and applications. Even more, right, the authors do the great job of showing specific examples of pilot projects the group has implemented. So a very, very well done from our California colleagues in UC Davis, UCI, UCLA, UC San Francisco, and UCSF. In closing out the October 2023 Literature Review Series, our non-clinical articles, aka where you feel some sweet emotion. And our article today, published in JAMA, is written by Dr. Spiro, entitled A Commitment to Making Healthcare Personal. And it's a very personal story describing his mother being hospitalized and his experience, but not his experience as a pediatric emergency medicine physician, right? But as a patient's family member. And I think when you work in healthcare, you can empathize and understand being short-staffed and the like, you didn't get your pudding, what have you, but you also recognize unacceptable impersonal care, and I think at a level of which some of the lay public would not. So the author kind of talks through their experience, but it ends on a really positive note. I want to read the last little blurb here. It shines not only the light on his mother's memory, but this great message at the end. It says, let us all commit to making healthcare more personal by working together. With intention, we can improve care for all patients and families, especially those who are most vulnerable. Well said, something we should all try to achieve. And with that, with the huge, huge help of Haley and Caitlin, we have thus concluded our October 2023 Literature Review Series. Wow. Another huge, huge thanks to Caitlin and Haley reviewing all the pertinent literature from October 23, all while during this, the dog days of residency, folks. So be sure to reach out, let Haley and Caitlin know what a great job they did. I certainly appreciate you both. So thank you all so much.
Thanks so much for having us, Nick.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
And another big thanks to Haley Burns and Caitlin Simonson. You can find Haley on Twitter X at Haley, HAILEY_RX36. Reminder, 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness Bracket. Fill that out, vote, do all the things. And then, of course, as with all Literature Review Series episodes, our reference list with the articles that we covered today and more is featured in the podcast episode description, as well as the website pharmacy2dose.com. But until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only, does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials in the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.